I'm Christopher Lydon. Kicking the tires of this web we're on, Cass Sunstein may be the preeminent worrier that the internet is bad for democracy. In practice, he says, it's less an open forum than an echo chamber of our own loud voices. The commonest links are to like-minded people, partly because the technology is marvelous at finding out your taste and filtering your music and your news to fit it. If you like this book, as Amazon says, or that political opinion, you'll love another one just like it, and before you know it, the common ground or the street corners, the general interest papers and magazines we used to share have all been fragmented and isolated and polarized down to the cellular level, where we see what we know and hear what we like, but seldom do we meet an unfamiliar experience or a generally shared one. Would you regulate the web to avoid such a nightmare? Cass Sunstein would, as the conversation continues. Audio streaming provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting provided by Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. Also by Gail Mazur, whose new poetry collection called They Can't Take That Away From Me is available at amazon.com. And by the 1999 Bullingen poet Robert Creeley, Trust to Good Verses Then. I'm Christopher Lydon. It used to be that all a regular web surfer had to worry about was the privacy of your emails, your purchases, your cookie trail. Now, says our guest, Cass Sunstein, if your life online is too narrow or too specific, if you're mainly reading American League baseball statistics or right-wing politics, or if you've noticed that all your favorite websites and sources think the way you do, you may be guilty of putting democracy at risk. Are you surfing alone out there, webheads? The way this fragmented country is said to be bowling alone. In his provocative book, Republic.com, Cass Sunstein, who is professor of law at the University of Chicago, is worried less about your social life than about our political life together under internet media that tell a lot of people more and more about less and less. Your stocks, your basketball team, your hometown news. The problem is that personalized media can also filter out the unfamiliar, the unsolicited opinion, the universal news that real democracy needs to feed on. We're getting the Cass Sunstein warning about the web this hour and talking back to him. Consider your own web life, listeners, and give us a call at 617-450-2023. Cass Sunstein, there may be a technological tilt towards social isolation on the web, but who says it actually works that way?
What we have is a lot of diversity out there. A number of people are using the internet so as to broaden their horizons, but we now know that a lot of people are using it to specialize and just to go to conservative sites or liberal sites or sites that specialize on Russia or sites that specialize on baseball. The full data isn't in, but we have enough to know that millions of people are narrowing rather than broadening their horizons.
You worry that, you say explicitly that there's a temptation, an opening to extremism,
yeah,
even violence in this technology.
Yeah, the worst is hate groups, and I did do some research on hate groups on the internet. And what happens in normal kind of pre-internet life is that people like who are teenagers or young adults or older who are tempted to be obsessed with racial hatred or ethnic hatred or religious hatred get over it because they're isolated in a geographically diverse place like Boston or Chicago. But the internet provides these domains, these kind of clumps, where people can be recruited and find like-minded others. So what we know is happening is that people who want to, you know, be obsessed with how the Holocaust didn't happen or how one or another ethnic group is really bad and deserves to be shipped off, they can really find one another and unify on the web. And when that happens, they don't kind of stay where they were. They become still more extreme.
What's the evidence of that?
Well, if you spend an hour, I don't advise that anyone does, but I did. If you spend an hour or more on the internet, you'll find a bunch of sites in which people are doing exactly this. And there's been some work done by journalists and others about recruiting by hateful groups and how they use the internet very effectively as a recruiting tool.
Well, sir, surely the net empowers very marginal groups who, as you say, if they were geographically or sort of technically isolated, wouldn't amount to a hill of beans. But that can work in a lot of good ways, too. I mean, there are sufferers from rare diseases who find a kind of common cause on the web. There are collectors or scholars. What's the real balance of plus and minus here?
Well, I think to have a thumbs up or thumbs down would be really a way of not thinking clearly, and kind of it's the culture of the soundbite, the thumbs up or thumbs down approach. If we have to have
but balance the costs and benefits here. I mean,
yeah.
There are lots and lots of benefits of letting small groups meet as they never could before.
Yeah, the benefits outweigh the costs hugely. So if the question is, are we better off with the internet than without it, I think the answer is obvious. We're a lot better off with the internet. But to me, if I may say that, the question is really boring because it's so obvious. And this isn't a criticism of you at all. It's a criticism of people who want to celebrate the internet so much that they're not willing to look at some of the problems it might create. And the really good things about it, you know, we know about that now. So the benefits on balance are fantastically high and much higher than the costs. What I think it's worth drawing attention to is that we do have a problem in this country in which like-minded people talk too much to one another, and there isn't enough discussion and recognition across ideological and even racial lines. And the internet, just because it makes it so easy for people to isolate themselves, not in their own home, and not as kind of bowling alone, but in groups of like-minded people, so that we have less in the way of common experiences and we have more in the way of social fragmentation. Those are the risks that the internet creates.
In the book, you have some interesting numbers about African-American and white preferences on the internet. The top 10 white web groups don't overlap at all with the top 10 black groups. What does that tell you?
Well, the data is actually more clear on television, where the most popular African-American shows are the least popular white shows, and pretty much vice versa. What it tells with when there's similar phenomena on the internet, what it tells is that you have people getting entertainment and, to some extent, news from very different sources. Now, if it's the case that you're getting entertainment from different sources, that's not a problem. It's good because people are probably more entertained. But if people are getting their news from really different sources, we saw this a little bit with the O.J. Simpson verdict. You've got people hating each other and maybe demonizing each other and not understanding one another's perspective. And in the racial area, that's really dangerous. We've had
Social isolation is not born on the web, as you say. I mean, the most striking evidence of it may be on television and television watching. But also, I mean, just a few weeks ago, we were talking about that book, The Well, a sort of contrary case of how a web community really did build something that hadn't been there before. Again, strike a balance of costs and benefits in the web's ability perhaps to isolate, but also to make neighborhoods.
Okay, that's very helpful. And some people complain about television, that it's an isolating medium. And I think that is a good complaint. The internet isn't an isolating medium at all. So I wouldn't want to say that the internet is something that, like TV, makes people kind of passive couch potatoes where they don't talk to anybody.
Right.
Just the opposite. What the internet does that's a little worrisome, and what TV does less, is that it allows people bond together and to create communities, not of place, but of ideology or topic. And so what we've seen in the last 5 years, a big displacement of geography as the way that people constitute themselves
right.
in a group, and instead ideas or commitments or topics. And what's bad about that isn't that people are going to be lonely. I don't think we have to worry about that very much, but that they're going to be balkanized or fragmented. So if you have a situation where people who read a right-wing magazine only read that, or people, instead of reading Time or Newsweek, only read left-wing magazines or left-wing selections from Time or Newsweek, then we have a problem.
So what would you do about it?
Well, I think the first thing really to do is just to get the problem out there so that the hurrah, hurrah, hurrah is a little more reflective and sees the downside. In terms of what we ought to do, I think a kind of short-term nice thing that can be done is to have links and hyperlinks. So if you have a right-wing site, it would link to a left-wing site, and vice versa. If you have a magazine that's devoted to one set of environmental issues from one perspective, it would be linked to other perspectives on environmental issues.
Would you build it into the box? Would you require a left-wing group to do it? Is the government involved here? How does it?
Well, the first thing I wanted to see happen is this to happen voluntarily. In fact, in doing this book, it occurred to me I have my own little website. I don't think anyone's really interested in it, except maybe my sister. But I thought we should have a link to some other sites, that is, sites of people who have very different views from mine. So I put links in to sites of one person who's far to my right and one person who's far to my left. And that's a kind of a tiny little gesture in the direction of democracy, really tiny.
Speaking of people whose views are different, John Perry Barlow is on the line, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, cyber cowboy, techno-libertarian. Do you acknowledge there's a problem, John, in a tendency toward extremism or isolation?
I used to worry about that a lot more. I mean, back in the late 80s and early 90s, I would see these dense little communities gather, and I was afraid that you were going to see self-ratifying reality distortion fields crop up all over the web or all over the net. But frankly, I haven't seen it happen in the virtual world to the extent that it seems to be happening, and maybe abetted, but I don't think so, in the physical world. America, which is the political environment that I'm most familiar with, seems to be filled with extremist groups all of a sudden, but they don't seem to be using the internet as their venue of convention. They seem to be using magazines primarily and television.
Well, even non-political extremist magazines, I mean, the disappearance of the general interest magazine, or the decline in every supermarket magazine stand is very, very striking. It has absolutely nothing, well, it has nothing to do with the web.
It has to do with advertising and the desire of the advertiser to make sure that everybody who looks at the ad is a potential customer for the product. And so advertising has driven specialization in the last 15 years to a much greater extent than the internet has, in my view.
Professor Sunstein, what's driving the specialization of the web?
I think the market, that what people want to do is appeal to consumers and make money. And if you have the technology that allows you to specialize, you're going to do that. And so the market is what's really great, and the market's what's a little dangerous.
John Perry Barlow, I mean, I don't need to remind you, but others, that you're the author of the 1996 Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, in which you told any wannabe regulators, including, I suppose, Professor Sunstein, that you are not welcome among us. You have no sovereignty where we gather. That the internet is an act of nature, grows through our collective actions, and doesn't need suggestions, even much less regulation of fairness doctrine.
I don't think I ever tried to turn our collective back on suggestions. And I think that, you know, the measure that Dr. Sunstein is proposing is a perfectly fine one. I can't imagine that anybody is likely to adopt it, or at least the sort of folks that he would find problematic, or that I would. And I can't easily conceive of the regime necessary to impose it.
Is it a dead letter? And is it a
I don't know.
The question is it a false problem?
I think that it may be a false problem. Because I think that there is something about the random quality of interaction in cyberspace that tends to bring you into contact with people who aren't like you and who don't believe what you believe, and ideas that are not like yours and tend to call yours into question. I would be more, to tell you the truth, I'd be more concerned if search engines were more accurate. Because the fact that they're not accurate means that you're constantly being exposed to things that you wouldn't have intended to be exposed to.
That's sort of the issue right there. Does the internet lead to more surprise, more discovery, more street corner accidents than it does to fanaticism?
For me. And also, you know, once this probably doesn't say much about the rank and file believer. You know, your average brown shirt. But for me, as somebody whose views are fairly well known, and I would think it might be also true for Professor Sunstein, and I'd like to hear what he has to say, but I find that having views that are well known in cyberspace means that I get a huge amount of contradicting, inflammatory, often threatening mail. And I have to deal with those interventions. Mm-hmm. And I don't find it sufficient to flame back. I want to try to engage the person who doesn't like what I have to say and find out why he doesn't like it, which is a broadening experience.
You answer the flames. Professor Sunstein.
Yeah, I guess I'd want to step back a little bit. I don't disagree with anything really that's just been said, but if you look at the controversy over the 2000 election or the impeachment controversy, these were pretty ugly events for the country, and one reason was that people who agreed with each other were kind of talking and talking one another up into kind of frenzy, so much so that Bush thought Gore was stealing the election, or his supporters did, and Gore thought Bush was stealing the election, and his supporters did. The oddity, I think, of the Bush against Gore one was that both people were acting mostly in good faith, at least with their legal arguments. And you had very little sympathetic engagement with what the other side thought. So what I think we want to say most is that a democracy requires common spaces in which people can hear diverse views and also unanticipated, unchosen exposures. And those are really important. Now, with respect to the Internet, I'm not just concerned really with hate groups, but kind of conservative and left-wing groups that congregate around listservs or websites. And this isn't, you know, Bosnia. No one's going to kill anybody else, I don't think. We hope not. And it's not so good if people who read, let's say, Dissent, which is a left-wing magazine, only read Dissent so much so that, let's say, they end up thinking that people who read National Review, a right-wing magazine, are nuts or not really human or something like that. And it's completely right to say this isn't just an Internet problem. What the Internet does is to make it so much easier to specialize. What I'd like to see Dissent do is to create a kind of democratic link to the National Review, a National Review to do just the opposite. This isn't unrealistic. A number of sites do give links to opposing views, sometimes just as in order to be good citizens, sometimes because they think that the opposing view is so silly that it will kind of prove itself to be implausible. But in either case, this is a good idea. Now, with respect to the Internet, you can get a lot of surprises, but I have a friend who is really interested in Russia, and he gets maybe 40 stories a week on Russia, and he's a Russia specialist. Doesn't really read as much about other things as he used to. I have other friends who are ideologically very committed one way or the other, some conservative, some liberal, and they really read a tremendous amount of material that plays to their pre-existing views, and the Internet makes that easier. You can get, you know, 1,000 left-wing sites if you want, or right-wing sites if you want. In the course of doing this book, I've gotten more hate mail than ever, and what Justin said is completely right, and I, in a way, welcome it if it isn't just hate, if there's an argument there. And that's because you learn something from people who have strong opposing views. But a lot of people on the Internet, you know, aren't receiving hate mail, maybe sending it, but they're just really trying to amplify what they already think, and that's boring.
There's a related question here. Is the Internet and the web in general half as good for listening and learning as it is for speaking out, expression? In other words, I sometimes think it's a better megaphone than it is a listening device.
I think it's important you draw a distinction between the web and the Internet when asking that question.
Well, let's say the Internet.
The Internet is actually a conversation, and the web tends to be a publication.
This is a good point, and you can depends on who you are and how you want to use it. If you want to listen, you know, if you really want to learn about Egypt, and you really are interested in listening to what people want to say about Egypt, if you spend 45 minutes on the Internet, you can learn an incredible amount. But a lot of people who are using it who are interested in politics aren't learning to listen, except they're learning to kind of have the kind of distinctive pleasure that people get from hearing their own views put more firmly and emphatically and maybe clearly than they themselves can put their views. Now, that kind of pleasure, we all feel it sometimes, but it's not the best thing for a free society.
Could I ask you both?
I would agree with you there. I mean, I think that there's an awful lot of forwarded what he said. I mean, you run across something that resonates with you, and you forward it to everybody you know.
Right.
Right.
Which tends to ratify it further.
Right.
John Parabola, could I just ask, because you've both mentioned hate mail, I just wanted to raise the question about the sort of tone of voice on the web, and especially in anonymous flames.
Well, people talk louder when they don't have vocal cords.
That's interesting.
It's a nice point. And they can also treat the person to whom they're speaking as a demon rather than a human being.
Well, I noticed
that
a lot.
When you can't see your adversary, you can always objectify him into some kind of demonic quality.
Right.
Well, what's the implication there for sort of civil society?
It's not good. It's like Clinton turned out to be for many people, I guess like Nixon used to be for many people of another side, that is something like Satan. And if you think that everyone who kind of thinks Clinton was a pretty good president is a friend of Satan and an ally of Satan, or so too for Nixon, so too for George W. Bush, then this is really not good for people trying to work constructively on common problems.
But I would say, really, the problem, you know, if you're going to be concerned about a medium that is causing difficulty of that sort, you want to look at broadcast media and not at the internet, because the demonization of Clinton was a radio phenomenon. And in fact, it seems to me that...
As in Rush Limbaugh, you mean? Or?
Yeah, and yeah, you know, a host of other Rush Limbaugh lookalikes. Well, not lookalikes. Now, nobody looks like Rush Limbaugh. You know, I find that the mass media want to make you stay within their definition of your point of view, and they will make you buy your own poster eventually. On the internet, there's been a general unpacking of what's left and what's right. I mean, I find myself being miscellaneously characterized as left or right, depending on who wants me to be, you know, their imaginary friend or their imaginary enemy. I think of myself as basically probably left of center, and yet I just was asked month before last to do a cover interview for the American Spectator, who found my views perfectly agreeable. Now, I think that if I'd been stating those views in conventional media, it would have been very clear to everybody whether I was a right winger or a left winger.
They would have made it clear.
They would have insisted that it be clear. As it is, nobody has made that insistence, and I'm in a position where I can state things without a political identity at all.
That seems to me a great point. I want to extend it a little bit because it really helps move the ball forward. There are some things like a daily newspaper or a weekly news magazine that are kind of general interest sources, and they tend not to do what broadcasters sometimes do, this kind of demonization and categorization. And one thing that I think democracy really does well with is if it has these daily newspapers or these general interest sources, not as the only source of information, but as something that exposes people to plenty of topics and points of view. If you look at your daily newspaper today, I'm sure you'll see that. Then there's the internet, which is a billion different things, including general interest sources, CNN.com and so forth, and very specialized websites that are at least as bad, I think, as the radio and broadcasters that we can complain about. Then there's this third category, which is these radio and TV stations, which say, you know, he's left, therefore he's bad, or therefore he's good, he's right, you know, this kind of simple categories, which is that's also not very good for democracy.
But would you stand by for just a moment? I want to introduce Paulina Borsuk, who wrote Cyber Selfish and has been for years a kind of warning or deflating the hype of the techno culture. Paulina, what's to worry about here and what's not in the fragmentation of our thinking?
Well, I have to say I really agree with John here.
It must be painful.
No, not at all. I'm more worried about sort of the balkanization of all society and all of media. And in this case, I just see the net and the web as kind of an extension of what's going on overall, sort of an increasing people retreating behind gated communities and the... what I always talk about is all the media concentration, and all you can get sort of published is 10 tips for a tighter tummy or 3 days of fatter profit margins or Oprah's chef's, a veterinarian's memoir of child abuse. I'm kind of more worried about, and that basically most publications of ideas, and again, I'm talking about dead tree media, or even on the web these days, they are basically philanthropies. I mean, there's kind of no market support for them. So I worry about that kind of stuff more than I worry about what goes on the web, in a way.
Are they related?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the fact that the general interest web content publications are either gone or going down is kind of part of the larger societal problem or the Robert Putnam Boeing Alone problem, that we kind of have a general dilution of, social capital. And kind of the marketization of everything. I'm kind of more worried about that than, you know, random wackos only talking to each other, except as part of this larger phenomena. I don't know if that, I'm sorry I'm being
Professor
moderate Sutton. Here. But
I've never heard you agree with John Perry Barlow before, but that's good.
We both agree on the importance of free speech.
Do you disagree with Cass Sunstein?
Well, I tend to be, it's not so much I disagree, I tend to be sort of more a despairing pessimist, and like this sort of general kind of come let us reason together mindset has been going out the window for a really long time. So I don't know why it's going to be, you know, it'd all be very nice to link to things, people who disagree with you, and that's a fine thing, but the number of people of that fundamentally moderate, capable of holding two contradictory points of view in their head at the same time, personality, they're not very widely distributed in the population.
And they're not really the problem.
No, absolutely not.
Professor Sunstein.
Yeah, the Internet's really young, and what people are like is partly dependent on what institutions do. So I wouldn't be pessimistic about anything at this stage. There are experiments in the United States and all over the world where people are trying to create these kind of public spaces on the Internet, not with government compulsion, mind you, and they're getting some public funding and they're getting some private support. It's much too soon to despair about what they're exactly going to do. It's true that the crazy people who just like, you know, Holocaust denial websites aren't likely going to want to deliberate in common. But it's also true that most people who read conservative or left-wing magazines are interested much of the time in reading what the opposing view is. Maybe they'll learn something. Maybe they'll change their mind.
Could I just suggest, Professor Sunstein, the question isn't technical, really. It's sort of social and political about who kind of calls the tune or sets the standard of, centrist established thinking. And it seems to me your book is kind of a lament for the fact that those general interest publications can't seem to do it anymore, and you're obviously worried about this sort of techno anarchy in which, you know, a billion opinions bloom and they all have a kind of equal mini moment on the web. Is that something really to worry about?
Yeah, I really think so. Not that the daily newspaper is fantastic in every way, and not that we want it to have a monopoly. In many ways, the fact that we have the Internet adds diversity, and that's really good. But if we end up having a situation where people, not just nuts, but people who, like, vote, and voted either for Bush or Gore, are really talking mostly to people who agree with them or laughing at people who disagree with them, and if our communications technologies make that kind of self-selection tons easier than it was 50 years ago. It's not that things are worse now than they were 50 years ago, but things are in that respect worse than they were 50 years ago.
Let's take a short break. We're talking about Cass Sunstein's book, Republic.com, a sort of general warning that there's a profoundly anti-democratic tilt in all this isolation on the web. Agree or disagree, but give us a call at 617-450-2923. John Perry Barlow and Paulina Borsuk are also with us. Give them a call, 617-450-2923. We'll be back after a short break. Audio streaming provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting provided by Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. Also by Gail Mazur, whose new poetry collection called They Can't Take That Away From Me is available at Amazon.com, and by the 1999 Bullingen poet Robert Creeley, Trust to Good Verses Then. I'm Christopher Lydon. We're talking about the way the web actually works at 617-450-2923. Our guest, Professor Cass Sunstein at the University of Chicago, in his book Republic.com, says the web isn't really a marketplace of politics and ideas so much as a mass of links to like-minded people, a breeding ground, he says, for extremism, group polarization, where people hear louder echoes of their own voices. Eric Saltzman is on the line. He runs the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. Eric Saltzman, do you take this warning seriously?
Hi, Chris.
Welcome.
It's a very interesting discussion, and there's a lot of validity, I think, in what Cass has written. I think there's another perspective to take a look at as well. For me, I think the real monoculture...
Monoculture.
The real risk of a monoculture, that's what Cass is talking about, a monoculture or many isolated, balkanized monocultures.
Many monocultures.
Many monocultures. But I think a bigger risk of the monoculture is the monoculture of consumerism, which seems to be more and more predominant anyhow. That's the one that it seems to me the bigger threat. So,
Meaning exactly what, Eric?
Well, if you want to take a group that Cass has talked about, teenagers. Teenagers are just completely captured, by products, by product placement, by being sold. They listen to the same 50 songs, they wear the same clothes, and I think they're being groomed more than anything. By large companies to be consumers. That's their, to use the real estate term, that's their highest and best use.
You speak from experience.
Yeah, right. I have a new teenager. So I'm getting used to it. He doesn't have a disposable income, but as soon as he does, I know what he'll be buying. And I think that the internet provides an escape from that. There's a good chance that a lot of what Katz says is true. But there's a good chance that these kids and the rest of us will use the internet if it can remain or become more interactive, if we can keep access open, if we can keep information flowing freely. This is something John Perry Barlow knows a lot about. If we can keep intellectual property rules fluid, then I think we have a chance against the consumerist monoculture. And I think the web is probably one of the best protectors we have.
My anecdotal evidence,
John Perry Barlow,
would support that. I have three daughters, all of whom are a little older than yours, your kids. But because they're online, they have turned away from television to a large extent, and their value as a readily accepting target market for the folks who want all teenagers to turn into a monoculture has definitely gone down.
Mm-hmm. Cass Sunstein, you say that the whole doctrine of consumer sovereignty as opposed to political sovereignty is the problem in the web, and it's not an antidote at all.
I'd say more it's a general social problem, including a problem for constitutional law, where commercial speech is starting to get the same protection as political speech. So I think it's very important to distinguish between a citizen and a consumer. I think the Internet's more of a mixed bag on that, that one thing the Internet is used a lot for is buying. And companies are incredibly agile at figuring out now, if you bought this, then you're going to buy that. And the danger is if you buy one thing, you're going to get 6,000 very seductive emails saying that you like something like this just as well. So I think this is not just a solution to the problem of consumerism. For many people, including my 11-year-old, it is partly a solution to the problem of consumerism. But for a lot of people, it amplifies the kind of consumption treadmill where people try to buy things that are as good as what other people have, and then they end up losing a lot of money and not ending up happier.
How could you regulate or fight consumerism on the web?
I don't think there's any way of regulating it, except we should regulate fraud and deception just like we do outside the web. But this is the government's standard role. I think the thing to do really is to have public consciousness of the overconsumption that the web can lead to just because people are so good, the companies are so good at tracking the sort of thing you'll like.
But there are, Chris, there are some, I think, a few things we can do. We can make sure that internet cable systems, for instance, if they provide internet access, don't have the ability to limit what their internet subscribers see, who they can go to, whether they can filter, so you can't go to one site or another site or one company or another company. So that's very important. And if the architecture of the internet, and when I say architecture, I mean both the legal architecture, the intellectual property questions, and the physical architecture, and the monopolistic architecture remains more or less open and more or less fluid, then people will make the choices they make in a democracy. At least they'll have a shot. So I think that's an important antidote.
I don't know if I can butt in here.
Please, Paulina.
There's something I want to bring up here, which perhaps sounds a little tangential, but it's not. But when I think of my younger friends, by which I mean 35 and younger, and let's talk about things that get published on the web. And suppose you had an article on chicken, and there was an article on chicken on Aunt Sadie's website. That's fine. And then say there was an article on chicken in the Tyson Farms website. And so you're not going to find anything there about, let's say, factory farming and salmonella and stuff. And then let's say there's an article on chicken on the Bon Appetit website, but you don't know the provenance of that article. Was it really advertorial, provided for free by Tyson's Farms? You don't really know. And then let's say there's an article in Salon on, I don't know, rare breeds of African chickens or something. And to my younger friends, all of those things are the same because the fact it's online as opposed to in dead trees. And when I have discussions with them and I say, consider the provenance of the information, was it edited, who has a stake in it, who benefits from that, that's a really confusing idea for them. And they've grown up in a so much more corporatized time that they haven't thought about these kind of worrisome questions of where does the information come from. And similarly with my younger friends, you know, they are in the habit of turning much more to the net or the web to get stuff. They don't as often go to public libraries or any other kind of library. And if it doesn't exist before 1996, it doesn't matter. And a lot of stuff before 1996 isn't on the web. So I tend to be more worried about those kinds of issues. I call it the information provenance issue. And I don't think that's discussed as much. And it, not that it contradicts what anybody here has said, but I think it's another piece of the problem.
Yeah, but Paulina, don't you find that the younger generation is uniformly skeptical? I mean, they've been marketed at for so long that they tend to think that practically everything they hear is BS.
They're like anyone else. They're a kind of strange mixture of skeptical and sweetly naive and not knowing that things used to be different at a different time. And they don't, I don't know. I mean, when I try to explain to them the concept of something which is edited and like someone made judicious decisions or, you know, had a bigger picture and that's why they chose to publish that, that's, they don't even disagree, but they hadn't thought about that before. So it's as usual, it's a mix, I think.
There's actually a deadly example of this, which is in South Africa. The president found on the Internet that there's no connection between AIDS and HIV on a seemingly credible website, and because there was no kind of peer review or check of He believed it and said it, and a lot of people died in South Africa because they thought there's no connection between AIDS and HIV. Now, there's been backing away from that, but there isn't the kind of quality control you get.
Are you sure you're blaming that properly on the what he learned on the web?
100%.
Yeah, that's actually true.
It seems to me there's a connection here, Professor Sunstein, with your notion of freedom as a sort of deliberative, reflective, rather slow process, as opposed to the kind of rough and ready hair trigger assertion of freedom that we hear a lot about the web. Do you want to make that argument?
Yeah, there's an old idea of freedom. It's the Republican idea of freedom that the framers cared a lot about, where freedom has something to do with thinking things through and then figuring out what to do after you've thought, rather than just following your impulses or consuming. And there's been a kind of war in the meaning of freedom in the law of the First Amendment in the last 50 years, and there's kind of war in the country a little bit on the meaning of freedom. Now, both have something to be said for them, you know, and you wouldn't want government to say, well, you haven't thought enough about that, so you can't do it. But I think we're in danger of losing the old Republican conception of freedom that connects it with deliberation, and the kind of cyber-selfishness phenomenon is really the freedom as impulse, freedom as consumption.
But, Chris?
Please.
It's Eric Saltzman.
Eric Saltzman.
Berkman Center. Another way to look at this, I think, is reflecting on the curiosity of people and citizens or people or however you want to describe their roles. Cities remain very, very appealing to people. They remain appealing because you can wander around, you encounter people and things that you're not used to. Cities are still a big draw, and New York City, where I lived for 20 years until just this year, draws people from not only all over the country, from the Midwest and from the South and from all over the world, because they want that experience, and the cities around the world really do that for lots of reasons. Cities are more attractive to most people than theme parks are because of the curiosity and intellectual appetite that people have, and I think that's some of the tension that Cass is talking about. And I think that it's very likely that, yes, some people will be captured by narrowcasting and the daily me, but many more won't. And people become as well more sophisticated about provenance of sites, to answer Pauline's question. So I think we're headed in the right direction. We have to remember this medium is very new and our responses to it are very new, but I have a feeling we're going to figure it out pretty well.
The Daily Me, Eric Saltzman, thank you. The Daily Me is a reference to what was a kind of fantasy of 10 years ago in which your newspaper would have nothing but those things that you particularly were interested in. Bill Gates' definition of it, quoted in Cass Sunstein's book, spoke of walking into your living room 6 years from now, he said, you'll be able to just say what you're interested in and have the screen help you pick out a video that you care about. It's not going to be, let's look at channels 4, 5, and 7. It's going to be something that has pretty incredible graphics, and it's got an internet connection to it.
What nonsense. I mean, there's absolutely no evidence that this is coming to pass, though it's been predicted since the beginning of cyberspace. What is coming to pass, I mean, the new Daily Me, which is also interesting in view of this discussion, is the weblog, where you have the usually former professional journalist who's decided to become a web journalist and produces a paper that consists entirely of his views and information on subjects or a subject that he's known to be thoughtful about.
I think Gates might have a little more prescience than we've been suggesting. There is this technology called TiVo, you know, where you can turn your TV into your special shows, and TiVo is really smart. It'll actually know if you like this show, you'll probably like some other shows like it. And there are all these sites that can help you specialize, and lots of newspapers allow you to personalize, and lots of listservs, as we've been discussing, will forward things that'll be just your favorite sort of thing. You can get tons of that every day. So I think you may see the Daily Me not as literally what's coming, but a kind of metaphor for what's starting to happen.
John Perry Barlow, I wonder if you want to take the other side of the freedom argument, that it doesn't have to be that deliberative and it doesn't have to be that slow or orderly. I mean, I think of you,
we call you Cyber Cowboy for a reason. Yeah, except that I, you know, up until very recently, I was a Republican, partly because of an adherence to Republican in the descriptive rather than political sense. And I don't believe in perfect democracy. I think I have the same anxieties about perfect democracy that the Founding Fathers did. I don't know. I am not as worried about the death of deliberation as I might be, because I see that because of the increase in viewpoint and the number, you know, the density of the clamor, governmental efficiency has dropped considerably. And so we are deliberate whether we want to be or not, because it takes forever to get anything done.
Is that a remedy, Cass Sunstein?
Well, it can stop hasty action, but when the government, you know, is trying to figure out what to do with energy policy or environmental policy, it's not all good, even if it's slow. It's often, you know, something bad. There'll be some bad event or some kid will get hurt because a pesticide wasn't healthy, and then the government will do something. So it's too much logjam, too little exchange of reasons, I think.
Well, don't you also, you guys also...
Paulina Borsuk.
Sorry. that this sort of information glut, data smog, everyone feels assaulted by too much stuff all the time is part of what's really leading to this, you know, balkanization. It's like, you know, I'm being yapped at and broadcast to and so many media and so much stuff. I mean, the last thing probably any of us who are talking here is wants is to be put on yet someone else's list. And I think that's part of why people retreat to, I just want to hear about what I'm interested to, because I'm being blatted at all the time. And we are surrounded by argument culture and people with attitude up the snout. So I think this is kind of, you know, I just want to hear what I want to hear, and I want some relative calm in my life. I don't know. I always like to go meta on things, but I think that's contributing to, I don't know, my pessimism about all this.
Our phone is 617-450-2923. Pete. He's calling from Cape May, New Jersey. Welcome, Pete.
Good morning, Chris.
Welcome.
I'd like to ask your callers about search engines. I think most people access the Internet by typing in a term to a search engine, and they can come up with hundreds or, if not thousands, of websites they can go look at for more information. However, many websites accept payment for getting your website placed on there, and without your knowledge, you know, somebody may be paying to have a website listed in the top 10 as opposed to buried down towards the bottom. I wonder if there's any movement towards labeling websites or search engines that way. Is there any talk about maybe a non-commercial search engine that would be immune from commercial interests?
Interesting question. Cass Sunstein?
I don't think it is a problem, but I don't think it's a huge problem. And here's a situation where, kind of University of Chicago style, I think the market's just going to be fine. We have so many search engines out there now, and people tend to know which ones work and how different ones work. And so I don't really worry about that, even in the short term.
Are they fair, John Perriballo?
It strikes me that I mean, I would agree with Professor Sunstein completely on that, because you know, I know intuitively which search engines are driven by commercial interests, and as a consequence, I use Google, which does accept some payment, but is very, very moderate in the extent to which they allow that to leverage the search.
Professor Sunstein, I want you to deal with this sort of general question about the disappearance, not just of general interest publications, but of kind of Olympian editorial voices. This sense of a public interest what used to be a sort of liberal orthodoxy. Part of it seems to me, part of your concern is that there is no kind of standard New York Times editorial voice which we can take as a kind of beginning point of sound thinking, that these voices are terribly diminished, and we don't know who the authoritative new voices are going to be, and whether one will emerge out of the chaos of the web.
Well, I don't know that I want authoritative voices, and liberal orthodoxy is kind of a scary idea to me.
Underlying your book is a lament for a disappeared liberal orthodoxy.
Well, I wouldn't quite want to put it that way. I think nostalgia is really bad, especially because there's so many great things out there. But what I would want to say is very good is that if you have a newspaper, if it's liberal or not, if it's responsible, it's going to show you, you know, George Will you'll read and David Broder you'll read, and you'll see lots of different ideas. And also you might come
across... part of the reason people run to the web, that they don't have to sort of settle for that range.
Well, they should have some range if they're going to be able to think well. So maybe not that particular range, but some range would be really good. And a responsible newspaper has that. There's another thing that's worth underlining about what a newspaper does, which is that it gives, like a baseball team kind of, or a presidential election, it gives a lot of diverse people a kind of common frame of reference. And a diverse society really can benefit a ton from that, so that you'll have something in common, maybe, with people from really different walks of life. It works like as a common space. And if we lose that, we've lost a form of social glue.
It strikes me, though, that
John Perriello,
that you know, we have that range still available to us in the newspapers of record, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and those papers are now more important, I believe, than they were 5 years ago.
Of course, they're also on the web.
Newspaper readership is way down per family, and the reason is there's just so much material out there. So that people who used to get their news either from the newspaper or from the evening news, they just aren't paying as much attention to that, or not as many people are as they used to. And that's not all bad by any means, but you do lose something.
You know,
but I mean, maybe reading newspapers in paper is down, but don't you think that that there are an awful lot of people looking at newspapers online?
I think that, yes, absolutely.
That's traditional newspapers.
That's true, but I'm pretty sure the data is that the average family's readership of the daily newspaper is down on a per-family basis significantly, like a third of what it was 30, 40 years ago.
I want to agree with
Paulina
that
and
add to that, which is, you know, I live in Northern California, so my hometown paper is the San Francisco Chronicle, and I was really horrified when they did a complete rehab on their Sunday paper recently, and it was very clear that they were trying to reconceive it as, in large part, in terms of the opinion and sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, a kind of lifestyle feature stuff, as, you know, a giant dead tree weblog. And I thought, I can get that on the web. What I want in a newspaper is, you know, relatively, it is not just the soapbox stuff. And it was very clear that they are desperately trying to go after, you know, they see the web as an area of growth. They see newspaper readership is declining. How can we make ourselves more like a bunch of weblogs? And not that I think weblogs are a bad thing, but they're not the only thing. And I kind of hate to see a newspaper going more and more in that direction.
What do you see emerging as a kind of editorial voice, not exactly of authority, but of kind of setting the tone of political discussion, Paulina?
I don't see it, you know, I don't see that any one institution or person is considered authoritative that way. I mean,
that could be a good thing, too. Stand by. The phone's 617-450-2923. Mike is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Welcome, Mike.
Thank you. I think there's an argument to be made for heterogeneous populations being less dangerous than homogeneous ones. And, well, when you think about what happened in Rwanda or in Nazi Germany, the people were bombarded with a single message that enabled a very bad thing to happen in both cases. And I think that if there was more information available for people to counter that and to think differently, I think that's better. And so as much as I do agree with much of what you're saying in certain respects, I think...
With who's saying?
I'm sorry?
You mean...
With the arguments that these are issues that we should be concerned about. I don't think it's just like, oh, it shouldn't be a concern, but I think the web is possibly the ultimate form of freedom of speech. And I think that having more freedom is scary, but I think it's more powerful and in the end will be better than letting small groups of people have the major control over the information that's delivered.
That's a very... Mike, thank you. I mean, that's one for you, John Perry Barlow. Does that sort of view worry you, Cass Sunstein?
Well, I think that monopolies are really horrible. And if the question is, are we better off with the Internet than with a world with three TV stations, or maybe four. Of course we are much better, but what we shouldn't do is think that because things are better or even good or fantastic, that there's nothing to worry about. And if we have a situation where even relatively small percentages of Americans are concentrating themselves among like-minded extremists and not talking to one another, then we have a problem, something worse. I mean, do we want to really repeat the experience of the Clinton impeachment or Bush against Gore, or have things like that happening every 4 years worse?
But I don't think we've established that it had anything to do with the web.
Well, I wouldn't want to say that it is directly due to the web, but I think it is due to the broader forces of specialization and diversity, that those have aggravated the problems that we saw in connection with Bush against Gore and impeachment. Don't forget that Matt Drudge played very far from trivial role in the Clinton impeachment.
John Perry Barlow, I leave it to you to make the case for this kind of evolving mystery, which could be called anarchy on the web.
Well, I'd like to support what the gentleman from Amherst said. I think that the great perils of the 20th century, political perils, have all been wrought by monochromatic media, broadcast media. And one of the reasons that I've been so dedicated to spreading the internet and...
Give an example of the evil you're talking about.
Well, let's say Hitler, the Third Reich.
Okay.
I mean, the Nazis, which had a very slender support, once they grabbed the media, were able to create a uniform national support system where everybody essentially believed what they believed, because it was impossible to believe anything else. You were bombarded continuously with Nazi propaganda. And you can only do that in a one-way broadcast-style media system. You can't do that. Anytime you've got the internet, you can't do that. And I think that those kinds of totalitarian regimes are dead from the world now. They will never exist again as long as we have internet.
Paulina Borsuk, you were the last in. Do you want the last word?
No, that's okay.
Cass Sunstein?
Well, I think those are good points, but they're a little too comforting and a little too complacent. They're not wrong, but it's a little like America's reaction after the Soviet Union fell. You know, they're bad, we're good, and that was basically true, but we have a lot of work to do.
Well, the internet is far from secure.
We'll keep doing the work. John Perry Barlow, Paulina Borsuk, Cass Sunstein, and callers, and Eric Saltzman, too, at the Berkman Center. Thank you. We'll keep at it. Cass Sunstein's new book is called Republic.com. Thanks also to John Perry Barlow, Paulina Borsuk of Cyber Selfish fame, and Eric Saltzman of the Berkman Center at the Harvard Law School. Thanks also to New England Streaming Media for audio streaming of this webcast, and to the Berkman Center at Harvard. We had help today from Noel Flatt, Jeremy Bowers. The program was produced by Catherine Bidwell, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, and Tom Tiger at BNMP Studios at the Christian Science Monitor. Our senior producer is Mary McGrath. I'm Christopher Lydon. You can continue the conversation online at www.christopherlydon.org.